glad to jump in every now and then and listen. And John, good to hear your voice in there. And to MBR, this is KC2CUM back over to net control.
Very fine, Alan. And, yeah, the net has been around since 1982, so we're a little bit more than 34 years, more than 5,000 hours worth of technical nets. 10 solid years of them are recorded at amateurradio.tangovictor. I wonder if you knew K4NBC. He recently became a silent key, living in Florida, another broadcast engineer. I wonder if you happen to know him, Matt Allen. KC2ZUM, K2LIW.
I knew him on the air only, didn't know him personally. We've talked quite a bit in the past, and was very surprised of the and shocked of how he lost his life in an auto accident, and very close to home, as a matter of fact, as well. So that's how a lot of accidents happen. But didn't know him personally. Did not know him personally. Just knew him on the air when he was in the New York area on FM. I was still a tech then. But when I got to General, he was gone. Back to you.
And you're right. He did. He died close to home with an automobile accident. He had his own private helicopter on his property in his own hangar, so to speak. I think he had a pair of 200-foot towers. He was very well equipped. Interesting guy to talk to who used to sign into the TechNet. And we visit up in the New York State area from time to time. Now, anyone else within the sound of my voice with questions for Paul, WS2N, on the space report, or further questions on the TechNet of any subject we've discussed tonight, or even further questions for Eric as to what it's like in Hawaii, or questions for Alan of what it's like in Orlando, Florida. I'm going to first pass it over to you, Alan. You've been there for 2 months in Orlando. Do you like the weather? Do you think you're going to like it in the summertime? And probably it's not going to bother you because you can afford air conditioning. KC2ZUM for any info on that. What's it like there? Ham radio-wise or otherwise, K2IW. You got it, Alan.
Okay. Be happy to answer that. First of all, I have no problems in walking around in shirt sleeves here in December. It is an adjustment. As you know, I lived in Fishkill, New York for 5 years. 3 of those 5 years, I've had snow up to my waist. The XYL and I are tired of the snow. And, of course, that's not the reason why we moved here, though. We came here to help take care of my mother, who's not doing too well. She's in her 90s. We're still adjusting. What I don't like about this area is the behavior of drivers. Everybody seems to be climbing up everybody's rear end when you come to a traffic light or an intersection. They leave no room for an out in case something happens. But other than that, it's nice. It's different. As far as ham radio, I'm a member of the Bears and the Dares over here, and I do come in on that repeater every now and then on the Dares, on the Disney system there, to talk to people in New York. But it's nice, it's different, it's interesting in a way. I do a lot of mobiling these days. I have not gotten everything set up as of yet. I hope to by the first of the year and get back up on HF. Back to you.
Good information, Alan. I, as a strong enthusiast of radio towers, because I'm a VHF, UHF, SHF operator, so your antennas have to clear the local trees, and I like property with tall trees, so I'm a radio tower enthusiast. From what you've seen so far, how is the zoning laws for radio towers, for radio amateurs in Florida? If I'm putting up wire antennas, I'm guessing I'd have very little problem. But unless I've got a pretty big piece of property, there may be some local zoning laws that are a little bit tough for putting up towers. That's a guess on my part, and maybe you see it differently. And a number of states and a number of communities in those states eventually get smarter as time goes on, and they realize that even though hams are oddballs, to oppress them with excessive zoning law restrictions is really not the right way to go. They eventually come to that conclusion, the smarter communities, in my opinion. So I wonder what you've seen along those lines, Alan. KC2ZUM in Orlando, K2RIW in New York.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, in the last 2 months, I've done a lot of driving around from time to time, just exploring and looking at different areas. And I mean, Orlando is not new to me, but, you know, I haven't come here that often prior to moving here. And you forget, you know, some areas. I have not seen many towers around. Or, you know, because one thing I do when I'm driving around, I'm always looking at rooftops to see where the hams are, or even people with 11-meter antennas and whatnot. You just don't see much of it. Mobile-wise, I don't see, what do they call it, cosmetic, I forget the other word, license plates, as I did in New York. They're out there, but what I have noticed is there's a lot of reflectors. There's a lot of IRLP and reflectors and things like that, and that's pretty much the way they go. It's flat land out here. There's not a lot of tall buildings, so the range is very good with 20 watts, 50 watts, much better than New York. Of course, I had the country, the trees, the hills, and everything else. But range-wise, geographically, it's amazing the range of some of the machines that are out here. My disappointment is that there's so much powerful equipment, repeaters and everything out there, but they're underutilized. That's part of the problem, and I don't know why that is. But I have not seen many towers. The only towers that I see are at the amusement parks, and they're part of the ride. Rides, if that answers your question. Back to you.
It answers the question very well. I think that was Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, you know, we have the placing kick call. One of the things that many of the hams don't realize down there, especially when they come, on UHF, you can't operate more than 50 watts. Those are the rules. Check with the FCC. I actually applied for a permit to put a tower on the back of my house. Actually, the town welcomed it, and since there's a canal right there, they don't see it as a problem. But it's different than other communities. They have very restrictive laws, especially on the West Coast. And I also know on the East Coast, they're equally restrictive. So, like T4NBC, how he manages things, he's got to be way outside some of these incorporated villages and communities. So, T4RWK2, yeah.
Yeah, you're correct, Eric. K4NBC was living down in the southern portions of Florida. He had, I think, 8 or 10 acres of property really in the boondocks. That's probably part of the reason why he had his own private good-sized helicopter on the property in his own hangar. He was getting a little bit of flack, as I remember, from the local zoning board about that helicopter. And he had to, from my point of view, he had to be very careful of how he used it when he landed on his own property, because his pair, count them two, pair of 200-foot-tall radio towers with guy wires. If the blades of that helicopter hit the guy wire, life could get very complicated real fast, knocking down the tower and the tower falling on the helicopter and the blade of the helicopter being heavily damaged and maybe crashing. It's not a good scene. So that was lucky he had enough property he could land the helicopter far enough away from the towers and then wheel the helicopter into the hangar. I think he literally wheeled it into the hangar by going between the sets of guy wires of the tower, which was relatively close to the house. And I certainly miss him, because he was the one guy who managed to get for me that beautiful picture of what it looks like from the... it's a very high-resolution picture. Let me drop it. Mr. McNally of National Geographic got permission to get to the top of the tower on top of the Empire State Building while a repair of one of the antennas are being taken place. So he's at the tippy top of that antenna structure, 300 feet above the top of Empire, and he's up there with a very high quality camera looking down, and that particular picture is the most exciting picture you can imagine. And K4NBC managed to get me a copy of that. I knew that it existed. I saw various versions of that heavily lowered in resolution, because I guess it was really owned by National Geographic. And so he would sign into the TechNet rather frequently. He was an interesting fellow. So in theory, Florida should be very good on 6 meters. In other words, the openings across the Caribbean and across what do they call it now? Trans-equatorial propagation. I'd like to believe the VHF people in Florida on microwave frequencies going over the Gulf of Mexico to Texas and down into the Caribbean. If you're a VHF amateur, and maybe even an HF amateur, Florida could be a very fun place to live. KE2EJ, for anything you know about that. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. One of the things that I will say, because as you know, I operate HF at a car, when we're down there, it's like 20 meters never shuts up. Even at night, 80 meters can be, 75 meters can be interesting. Propagation is completely different than what we're used to up here. And if you're bored, turn the radio on. There's something there all the time. You just have to find it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
However, what Alan is saying is there's a whole lot of repeaters, and he makes it sound like they are unused most of the time. I know that there are certain communities which fall in love with their local repeater and their local friends. They talk to each other on the repeater, but it becomes a slightly closed society when a stranger comes into town breezing through on his mobile and gets onto the repeater. Quite often people won't respond to him. They realize that he's only going to be there briefly. They never get a chance to make a friendship, and therefore don't respond to him. I've seen that when I've driven across the United States. There are certain communities where you sign into the local repeater, and you'll get no response. I think that's what Alan is describing. KC2ZUM, K2RIW for comment. Go ahead, Alan.
That was true, say, a couple of years ago. I noticed that. Now, no, you do have people that come back to you, people that are on the road or in the mornings going to work or whatever it is. It is different now, I have to say that. But what I am saying is that without those few contacts, a lot of powerful machines are underutilized. You could throw the call out there, in the evening or sometimes the afternoon, and it's quiet. In the mornings, no, you do get some traffic. Not like you would in New York, say on this particular machine, or even upstate where I was. We had quite a few of the beacon machines or whatever. You could always find someone in the morning. It's just that there's not that much activity. I'm hoping to maybe one weekend, maybe Simplex, something like that. So I don't know really what it is, but I do have to say a couple of years ago, as a matter of fact, that was my exact complaint. I was here for a while, and, people just, they recognize an out-of-area call sign, and they really don't communicate with you. Now, for the reasons that you described, I don't know if it's not, gaining a friendship or something like that, or, just passing through. But I noticed, and especially coming down on the auto train, and using an HT in a train going through different cities, I found that I got the most traffic would have been, say, either in Atlanta, South Carolina, and Jacksonville. Everywhere else it was pretty quiet. Back to you.
Interesting. The vanity plate, I think that's the word you may have been looking for earlier, when a person gets a special license plate, and in the New York area, a certain percentage of us like to have a call letter set of license plates. I think you're saying that you have seen nowhere near as many of them in Florida. Is that sort of what you were saying earlier, Alan? KC2ZUM, K2LIW?
KC2ZUM, yeah. Affirmative, yeah. At least, you know, because I look. But then again, I notice that the state of Florida has different plates. They're not all the same. And it's possible that maybe I don't know what I'm looking for in a vanity plate for amateur radio. In New York, we're familiar. We know what it looks like. But here, and I look. You know, that's something that I do as a hobby. And I just don't see that. Now, maybe if that's for security reasons, I don't know. The one thing I do have to say, and maybe this is part of it, there's a lot of unlicensed and uninsured drivers in this state. And that could be part of it, too, you know. It's, you got to watch it down here, because if you get hit by somebody that's not insured a license, you know, you're up the creek there. So I'll do some more looking, and maybe by the beginning of the year, maybe I'll see something different. But so far, I have not seen any. And again, as I say, it may be that I'm looking for the wrong type of plate. I don't know. Back to you.
Go right ahead, Eric. And Eric, I was going to ask you a question. Why can't I think of it right now? You got it, Eric.
I just wanted to say down in Cape Coral, Fort Myers area, where we hang out, our place, it's relatively quiet, except in the morning. And during that time, local community really get together during that time. But if you listen through today, it's pretty much very quiet. There's a few repeated there happen to be a couple of high towers. They have incredible range. When you get down to Naples, it becomes a different story. But one thing that I did find, Larry, is there's one machine, which is an IOLP node, which is actually a guy who writes and maintains a combination program that does IOLP echoing and another system all in the same package. So he gets thrown for a loop every time they change things at IOLP. But anyway, when I listen to the net, then all of a sudden all these people, as soon as the net's over, lots of people show up. Oh, one more thing. Let me let it go.
And which net are you talking about, Eric? Go ahead.
This very net. Actually, tonight we've got Arizona, we've got Mexico City, we've got Area, Ontario. There's a number that show up here. By the way, that's the gentleman down there. If you do want to hook up by an IOLP system, all you have to do is dial up node 9126, and you're actually dialing into a reflector that has the net, and it's full time for this particular repeater. As far as license plates go, yeah, they issue them. They're, actually, the way the license plates are issued is by county, but and some of the counties have different rules, but you'll see them. When you see a ham license plate, you'll know it because it's more than obvious. K2RIW, K2K.
Earlier tonight, Eric, you said on UHF ham radio, you're not allowed to go above 50 watts in Florida. Is that true for the whole state of Florida? And is that because of Cape Canaveral and the Kennedy Space Center? Is that the reason for that? And is that only on 450? Can I run higher power on 1296 or 2.3 gigs? And once again, is that all of Florida? K2EJ,
K2IW. It's almost all of Florida. It's, I suppose Jacksonville down. I have to look at the map to give you the exact line. I believe it's simply because of Cuba and what we've been doing with our balloons and dirigibles. A bunch of interesting things that they've been doing. I don't know if they're doing them anymore since Obama changed things a little bit, but, yeah, it's more for military restrictions than anything else, and I believe you can operate your full legal limit on 1296 at about.
So it affects 450. Does it affect 220 and 900 megs, 902 of you, Eric?
Well, If you give me a minute, I can look it up. I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
So there's something magic about 450, and you don't think it's because of the Kennedy Space Center? At one time, the air defense identification zones that were being protected by ASR, no, what is it? I'm trying to think of the FPS-35. The FPS-35 radars that were stationed around the perimeter of the United States to protect the air defense identification zone, any place where we're, if you were within 50 miles of one of those stations, like Rhode Island is one of the places, you weren't allowed to run more than 50 watts without special permission. That's how it existed in roughly 1970. I'm not sure that's because of Cuba, although maybe it is. Over to you for any comments on that, Derek. KETJ, KJIW.
No, I don't know the exact reason. What you're saying makes perfect sense because, I mean, some of the radars are at 430 and 440. But, no, I can actually visit that and come back to you with a better response.
Yeah, the so-called Montauk Point radar on the eastern tip of Long Island, FPS-35, Airborne Instruments Laboratory had produced some of the video processing equipment. The main contractor for that was Sperry Gyroscope, it was called at that time. Harry Downs, W2HD, as he is now known, W2TUK, worked for Sperry at the time that radar was being produced. And Sperry won the contract because they decided to build the antenna 135 feet wide, which gave them a hell of a lot more over the horizon 440 megacycle radar range for doing the air defense identification zone observing. And so the good news is that that radar, when it worked, had some beautiful performance. Unfortunately, they made some huge mechanical errors on the rotary joint and the wind balancing and gravity balancing of that antenna. Therefore, the bearing on that antenna would burn itself up very frequently, and the antenna had a, and that radar had an awful lot of downtime. And when that radar was operational, let me drop it. I live in the center of Long Island. That radar was on the eastern tip of the southern fishtail of Long Island at Montauk Point. That antenna was 70 miles from me. That radar, when it was operational, and I'm listening to the 432 megacycle ham band, that radar, measured by me, was 120 decibels above my threshold. My goodness, was that thing strong. I could aim my antenna in the wrong direction and be heavily overloaded. I could disconnect the antenna from my 432 converter. And when the main beam of that antenna would sweep by my house, the pickup of that signal through the 12-volt wiring of my 432 converter would allow the signal to come roaring out of my receiver. My goodness, was that a potent radar. Wow. And then that's where I discovered that the blanking circuit that was in the auxiliary device you could buy for a Drake R4 receiver did such a beautiful job of blanking the IF strip. It had a switch in the IF strip that could do blanking of impulse noise. Let me drop it. And that blanker was so effective, I could aim my 432 antenna at the Montauk Point radar, where I'm getting pulses of signal 120 dB above threshold. I'm getting close to the burnout level of the front end of my receiver, if you know what I mean. And when I turned on that blanker, instead of the band being absolutely useless, I could hear a weak CW signal off the back lobe of that antenna. I'm aiming the antenna east toward Montauk Point radar, and somebody's on the 432 band, like Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, in New Jersey, and I had no trouble listening to him when that blanker was turned on. I've heard of night and day. Can you imagine suppressing 120 dB of overload signals by a well-designed blanker? There are blankers and there are blankers when it comes to impulse noise. I probably have told you that story a couple of times. KE2EJ, KJRIW, if you want to make a comment.
KJRIW, KJ, yeah, it's sort of like my hybrid car. You turn the engine off, it's like you can hear something on the radio. to be able to blanket and synchronous with this mode would be something. Anyway, I got the answers to the question. There's actually a bunch of reasons. One is 432 to 450 is used by military and other federal agencies for a number of applications, multifunction, position locating commission, test range, telecommand, flight termination systems that relates to Cape Canaveral, and other systems essential for national security. It's also used for land-based, ship-home, airborne radar systems. Let's see. They also say that the enhanced position, the EPLRS, the data communication network between radars, and they also go on to say weather observation systems and windfall firing systems, and they also say that it's command, control, and flight termination functions for numerous missile and rocket launching places. There you go.
Wow. Now, you did say 430 to 450. Does that mean if I'm on 429 megacycles, I might be able to do it?
420 to 450.
Okay, 420 to 450. Oh, well. Is it the whole state of Florida? If I'm 1 mile from the Georgia state line, am I still restricted? How are you, Eric?
Yeah, Coach, actually, I'm starting to look at the map now. It goes further north than that. There's also restrictions in the 220 region, and they have restrictions from 890 to, that's for the commercial folks. They even have restrictions. That's ham, 428. Now, that's commercial. That's cell phone. Actually, none of this is ham. A lot of commercial restrictions, but in the 220 to 225 megahertz, we have restrictions, so. And then there's a portion of 448 to 450, which is used by radio location as the primary holder of the band, so that means we really can't operate there. I'm sure they do, but there you go.
KC2ZUM.
I've got some more questions on this. Let's go over to Alan first. KC2ZUM. K2RIW. Go ahead, Alan.
Oh, thank you, KC2ZUM. I hope I didn't cut anybody off. I typed in the word break and I hit send prematurely. I wanted to say on the 220, I'm not 220, on the 2 meter and 440 machines around here, you can get into most of them with up to 2 watts, 2 to 5 watts with no problem, which is another good thing. I'm glad the restrictions are brought up because I didn't research that on the power, although I really have no intentions of going above 50. And the mobile, most of the time I'm 20 here. I can walk around the house with an HT and hit most of the machines, even that's more than 20 miles from here, which is pretty amazing. They must have some pretty good ears. And the one thing I wanted to mention also that I forgot, I am now about 9 weeks cancer-free. Before I moved here, most of the summer I was being radiated 5 days a week. I learned last Christmas morning at 10 a.m., I get a call from the doctor that I had cancer. And it was pretty interesting. So I had been under the radiation for 4 months, and that was why I was late moving down here. I was supposed to have been here, actually, last year. So I'm proud to mention that. And if there's any other questions on RF around here, we'll be listening. KC2ZU, I'm back to you.
WS2N.
Well recognized. Congratulations, Alan. Guarantee that's a happy thing to find. And maybe the local nice sunny weather, good vitamin D, vitamin C, is all very helpful. I've got some further questions for Eric, but we'll go over to Paul first. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
I was wondering if Alan could see any of the launches down there from, I think he said, Orlando he was in. I'm not sure of his location. But that's good news to hear. I didn't expect to hear that, but I'm glad you're doing better. I just wanted to mention the launch down in Cape Canaveral. You won't be able to see this one, but that's the Cygnus launch. And it's not the same as the cargo launches that we have up here, but this is, you know, it stands for Cyclone Global Navigation Satellite System. And that's going to be going up on the Pegasus rocket. They have a L-1011, that, you know, heavy wide-body jet that brings it up to altitude, and then they're going to drop it, and it'll launch from that and put these 8 satellites into orbit. And Dick, you would have liked to. I think we're running out of time, but how these satellites are going to detect the wind speed down below using the GPS system. And these are very small satellites. They only weigh like 60 pounds each, and they're very small, but they're going to cover the whole globe, these 8 satellites. Pretty amazing. But it's going to come out of Florida, so maybe Alan will see that on the news down there. I don't think we will. We don't get much news like that. Back to you, Dick.
I was in Orlando some number of years ago visiting Disneyland. I vaguely remember at the time I was in a small number of miles from Titusville, Florida, which is where the Kennedy Space Center is and Cape Canaveral is. So I'll bet you are in within visual sighting of launches from the Kennedy Space Center where you are, Alan. Is that true? KC4ZUM, K2LIW?
Yes, I've seen one launch. It was about 2 years ago that I was here. My father was in the hospital before he passed, and from his hospital room, the window of his hospital room, it was a breathtaking thing to see, because I had never seen a launch before other than, you know, working in TV or on the news or whatever. This thing went up, and I tell you, it looked like it came out of the parking lot here from the hospital. It was so close. It was just amazing. When you see these things on TV, that's one thing, I got to tell you, if you're really into it. But to be looking out the window of a hospital and to see this thing go up, it's not just the flames and everything from the rocket itself. It just seemed like it went right up from the parking lot. And I'm saying, God, the flames are going to burn my car and everything. So that was one. It was breathtaking. I think my wife got a picture of it. Maybe I can get her to find it. And on her camera, she took a couple of stills, and then she put it into the video mode. So that was one. It was breathtaking. I'll never forget it because it looked like, you know, like you were right there. You felt it, although it was many miles away, but it was just a breathtaking thing to see. Back to you.
When you had that exciting visualization from that hospital room, what town were you in? Roughly how many miles do you think you were from the actual launch? Alan, go ahead.
Well, it was right here in Orlando. Dr. Phillips Hospital, if anybody's familiar with that. It was actually from where I'm living now. It was just about 10 minutes from where I'm living here. I'm not sure of, I'd have to ask my mother tomorrow because, you know, they've been here for 20 years and have gone down and seen a lot of the launches, you know, just driven there. It's hard to say in miles. All I can remember is, you know, I could have not reached out the window and reached towards it, but it was like, say, because this particular hospital had a helicopter landing pad, and I grew up right off of a naval hospital base where I used to see helicopters going and coming all the time, especially bringing the troops home from the Vietnam War. But it just, it's hard to describe. It was just like you're... It was right there. I would have to say it appeared from the window like it was at least 200 feet away from me. And it was, in the first sense, it was a little scary because at the angle that it went up, it looked as if it was going to curve. But in terms of miles, maybe next week I'll be able to give you that answer back to you.
You know, hidden in your brain may be the answer, Alan. Sound travels at 5 seconds per mile. If the place in Orlando where you were at the Phillips Hospital was 5 miles away, and you knew that a launch was going to take place, so you saw the very bright light of that launch, and if 5 times 5, 5 miles, 5 seconds per mile, if 25 seconds later you started hearing the sound of the launch, that would be an extremely strong confirmation as to how far away you were. So, do you remember how long you were watching the bright flash before you started hearing the sound? Could it have been like 30 seconds? KC2ZUM, K2LIW.
The honest that you know, I could not remember. At this time, I'm trying to think about it because, you know, we felt the vibration. And it wasn't just seeing the flames. It was seeing the rocket. You know, I gotta think about it. I just remember it was very exciting to see. But you saw the whole rocket go up, and that was the thing. It seemed like I was a couple of hundred feet from it. That was the thing, from the window. And then you felt the vibration and everything. Timing it, I don't really remember right now, because it was like, at first my back was turned to the window, and then when my father noticed it going up, I turned around and we all looked at it, and my wife started to photograph it, and we just saw it going up, and she followed the flames with her camera for a little bit there. But I couldn't tell you, it was just one heck of an experience. Back to you.
I wonder if it was orange-looking or white-looking, that would tell me. He must have thought of one of the big ones, probably a Delta IV or maybe a Delta IV Heavy.
Yeah, roughly what year was that, Alan?
Well, let me see. What is this, 2016, 15? So that would have been, I think it was 2014. It was 2014, and it was June 8th or June 9th of, I think, 2014, because it was my father's birthday, and he was in hospital for surgery, and that's all I can remember of it right now, but I could give you more accurate information next Sunday, because my mother, she wouldn't have forgotten it. Back to you.
I'm guessing, Paul, with that information, you can pin it down exactly. I'm going to go to Paul, and then Eric, in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that'll take me a minute, but very good. Give me a minute. Go over to Eric.
And Eric, I'm the creator of the strip line, K2LIW strip line, parallel kilowatt amplifier. It runs a kilowatt of input power, 700 watts of output power, single sideband or FM. So if I'm putting out single sideband bursts of near a kilowatt, it sounds to me like all of the state of Florida are not allowed to use that amplifier of mine. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
No, I'll be talking to UHF, yeah. I'm talking to VHF, no. What I want to say was that Orlando is due east of the Cape. You draw a straight line, a longitudinal line, and you'll run into the Cape. And I believe it's somewhere, I don't remember whether it's 40 or 60 miles. Not that far.
That's a lot of miles by my standards. In which case, 40 or 60 miles, Alan would have never heard the sound. He just would have seen the bright flash. And by the way, you said Orlando is due east. Due east of Cape Canaveral is Atlantic Ocean. I think you mean Orlando.
I said due east of Orlando.
Now I understand. Okay. You're right. And, So from all you can tell, on UHF, 432 megacycles, for instance, anywhere from 420 to 450, my parallel kilowatt amplifier, even in the single sideband mode, cannot be used legally in the whole state of Florida? And does that include all of the northern border, for instance, from what you can tell, Eric, KE2EJ, KQRAW?
Well, I've only got it right now is in minutes and degrees and seconds, so, and I'm looking on my phone, but, yeah, I believe it's a little bit north of the panhandle.
Wow. Now, the panhandle itself includes, I'm trying to think of a section of Eglin Air Force Base. Also, there's another Navy base out there. For all we know, there's another restriction because of the panhandle Navy base. I can't think of the name of that one. Over to you, Eric.
No, well, anyway, anybody that's interested can find it easily enough. I put that out there just in case the gentleman down there isn't aware of it. Now he is.
WK2J.
Among the FM people, only a very small percentage of them run more than 50 watts. And my guess is if you ran 51.5 watts in Florida, I don't think you're going to be arrested. I suspect that it would be a victimless crime, if you know what I mean. But I guess at the kilowatt level, 1,500 watt peak envelope power level, I guess they're worried. And because of all the equipment they use on those frequencies in that area. And that would cramp my style a little bit, because with that parallel kilowatt amplifier, every Tuesday night for four solid years, I could talk from Long Island down to Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 airline miles, a single sideband. And we held that QSO for four solid years every Tuesday night. Just couldn't believe that a 430 signal could go that far. My radio horizon, my optical horizon is 40 miles, and I'm talking 480 miles. That's 12 times further than my optical horizon. I'm talking with the radio on 432. So with the right kind of equipment, you can get some awful nice range on sideband with a good size antenna. K2LIW listening. Does anybody within the sound of my voice have any further questions for Eric, Alan, Paul, me, particularly the guys in the Golden Horseshoe of Canada, VE3JRW, for instance? I wonder if Jim has any questions. So I'm going to stand by if anybody's got any question on any subject. Now's your time. K2LIW in the TechNet, and we're listening. Okay, Paul. You can tell us anything you want to about what future launches are about to happen. You've got about 5 minutes or a little bit more left, Paul. WS2N, K2IW, you got the floor.
Yeah, I think you saw Falcon 9, one of the Falcon 9 missions. Not necessarily a cargo mission, but it could have been, they launched private satellites for different countries, different companies on that Falcon 9 by SpaceX. There was quite a few of them in that time frame. And then right after, I think it was the end of June, the 28th, he had that failure. But tomorrow morning, NASA will have it on the NASA channel. It starts probably around 8:15, 8 o'clock, but the launch would be around 8:24, but when they would release the Pegasus rocket with Cygnus on board. But what I wanted to tell you was that they use the GPS satellites. They have the signal. There's no radar transmitter on these satellites, these eight satellites, and what they're going to receive is the GPS is always transmitting. It's going to they go down, hit the ground, and mix in with the wind, hurricanes, and that signal is going to come back, and that the satellite will receive that. It's going to compare. The satellite has receivers on top of the satellite. It's going to compare the actual direct satellite transmission from the GPS when we drop it. It's going to actually compare the different signals and then figure out the wind speed on the ground. There's going to be 8 satellites all launched at the same time by one Pegasus rocket, and they're going to drift apart from one another. There's no propulsion system on them. They're going to use the wings of the solar panels to either, you know, go edge on to keep it going faster, or have it tilted where it will slow it down, and it's going to take probably about three months to calibrate everything. They're going to drift behind, so each one will be about 5,000 kilometers behind one another. So if you do the math, it's going to be they'll be spaced evenly in orbit around one another. So it's an interesting project, this satellite thing they're going to launch tomorrow morning. But I just want to see the Pegasus, make sure that thing drops okay. They haven't done one of those in about 2 years. Back to you, Dick. WS to land.
Yeah, I got a further question for you, but Wes has one first. Into XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, how is that coordinated? 2 weeks after failure of Russian rocket with supply to the space station, we have Japanese launch it, and were it prepared, it must be a rocket. We're waiting for such an event, and who is going to pay for it? Is Russia going to pay for a failure and for the cost of Japanese launch and treasure?
You got it, sir, Paul.
These are all planned missions to go up, and then if Russians screw up, they'll pick up the tab on their failed progress, just like they did a couple of years ago when they had a failed progress launch. Japan, they launched the HTV, the transfer vehicle, 10,000 pounds. That was planned. It was supposed to go about 3 months ago. They found a leak on that spacecraft on the ground. So that was delayed about 3 months. And that will be docking with the space station on Tuesday. So, SpaceX was supposed to go up the 16th, but they didn't get clearance from the FAA yet. So they're going to probably go up in January. And with their next launch, and then probably a launch or two after that, they'll be sending another cargo mission to the space station. Back to you, Dick.
But the question is, if, let's say, Japanese were not scheduled, is there backup option? And is the party that failed responsible financially for another country sending their vehicle, for risk of vehicle with supply to a ship?
Yeah, there's no additional supplies that were added to that. They don't have that capability. They don't have a last-minute door that they could open up like Dragon does. But their next vehicle that they are building, that should be probably launched 2020, does have that capability. So, you know, Russia would have been able to call up and say, you know, hey, we have these things, we're going to add it to your vehicle. And that couldn't be done on this one. But some of the missing things that burnt up, excluding the EVA suit, they had one on board, but some of the other things are going to be sent over to Dragon to bring up, or maybe even Cygnus going up on another Atlas V, probably. That would be in a month or two. They'll be sending that up. So there's a constant supply. We talk about it many times. It's 4 different vehicles that go to the space station. And they don't, you know, one country doesn't have to pay for the other country's misfortune. It's almost like everybody is self-insured back either.
You told us a little bit about these Pegasus satellites. I think you said there's 8 of them, and they're all going to be spaced something like a 5,000 kilometers apart or whatever, all the way around the Earth. And and they're going to be looking at the direct signal from above from the global positioning satellites, which gets reflected down to the ground, and there's an antenna on Pegasus aimed at the ground, which looks at the echo and makes a judgment on the weather of cyclones and tornadoes and whatever. I'm picturing this, Eric. Make believe the sun is straight overhead, and you're in a satellite, and you're looking straight down at the water, and you're seeing the water, you're seeing the sunlight glint off the water. You're going to see a whole lot of bright spots that are twinkling when you look at the water straight down in your satellite. And because your satellite is moving 17,500 miles an hour, that glint is a moving, very complicated pattern. The portions of the water that are favorably, the slant of the water is just right, so you're getting a solar direct reflection, a specular reflection from the water when you're looking straight down when the sun is shining on that water. Let me drop. Now, a radar signal is going to do something very similar, where it's not necessarily looking at water. It's looking at land. But portions of that land have just the right slopes. You're going to be getting a hot spots, glint, a whole bunch of speckled areas are going to be on that land because your satellite is moving. And now that speckled pattern that you're looking at on the ground is propagating down through the air and back up. And now by looking at Doppler spread and things like that, you're trying to make a judgment as to what the air is doing, what's the weather in that air doing. That sounds like a very complicated analysis procedure. Is that approximately what they describe, what Pegasus is going to be doing, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'm running out of time, but Pegasus is the launch vehicle. That's the one that's dropped from the L-1011 jumbo jet. Okay, and then after that gets into space, it's going to release the Cygnus satellites. You'll see it on the NASA site. It's the Cyclone Global Navigation Satellite System. So Cygnus has the 8 satellites. Those will be separated by about 5,000 kilometers, like you said, evenly spaced. But as they go over, they don't care about the land. These are really hurricane hunting type of things. They're going to be looking down. They want to see the winds of the hurricanes. They want to accurately predict the increase and decrease of the strength of the hurricanes, not so much direction of where they're going one way or the other, but the strength of them. That they haven't improved in on the last 20 years, but this will make a big improvement. So that's the deal with these things. They pick up the satellite that's roughly 1.4 gigahertz transmission from the GPS satellites, and that's enough to get through the clouds and everything. They don't even have to see the hurricane, and it'll go right through and hit the winds near the surface, and the satellite will be able to pick up that reflection of the winds on the Earth, and it's going to compare it to the signal, the pure signal directly from the same satellites, because it'll have receivers above it, below it, and then transmit it to 3 different sites around the Earth for evaluation. Back to you, Dick.
That's an interesting project. Very high tech. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1631. You've listened to Space Report 231. 73, you all. We've used up our time. Bye-bye for now. The glass slipper, our carriage is going to turn back into a pumpkin. Bye-bye. Back to you for any final words, Paul. Thank you. WS2N, K2RIW, clear but listening.
Okay, 8:24 will be the actual launch. It'll come on before that on NASA TV. AM in the morning. If they have some kind of cumulus clouds, they said would be a problem for launch the next day. Roughly around the same time would be the next window. So Pegasus is a cool looking rocket. It's built by Orbital ATK, has wings on it and everything, and it's the same one that launched a couple of scientific satellites for NASA, New Star comes to mind, about 2-3 years ago from California. They did it, and that was a very successful satellite that was launched by Pegasus. 73, guys, catch you next week. WS2N will be clear. Dick.
Bye-bye, you all.
73, everyone, have a very good week. KC2ZUN.
Great net as always. KTUPS Mobile.
Thank you, Rich.
N2NBR, KC2ZUM. If you're still there, could you come back to me? I forget the days of the CBS retiree net, whether it's Monday and Wednesdays or whatever. N2NBR, if you're still there, KC2ZUM. KC2ZUM, clear, closing stations.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
I'm up late. I'm 12 minutes late this morning before I get on the road. And after I do all the pickups and drop-offs, I got to go do jewelry duty today. So, I don't know, maybe my first case will be Hal. Are you going to be in jail today, Hal? Good morning, and 2MB.
I don't know. I'm going to go in after lunch. I figure I'll have a meal before they may incarcerate me. It's a better way to go. That look better, but... Bark will be present, I'm pretty sure, also. Rick, did you look over that method of feed patent?
Waiting for the beep. Yes, I did look over the patent, and I liked it a lot. And the words you gave me created an extremely different picture. A photograph is worth 1,000 words, as you know. When you're talking about a coax cable and stubs, I assume you were vertically stacking antennas on a mast and feeding with one piece of cable with T-connectors and stubs. That's what I was picturing. Those are the words you were using. Now I know the word stub was really the quarter wave object off to the left-hand side of a J-pole antenna, and the real radiator is three-quarters of a wavelength long, and that you had a 450, a 220, and a 2 meter, so to speak, all vertically stacked on the exact same mast with three separate cables going to the three separate stubs, and each cable goes to the semiconductor plus insulation that's wrapped around the stub as a inductive...
Repeater, timeout.
As an inductive slash capacitive coupling device. That's a very acute coupling device. By changing the number of turns and by sliding it vertically, you can eventually get an extremely good impedance match. The only thing I was a little bit troubled by is that the shield of each of the coaxes was not being locally grounded. Those shields were left completely open. And so therefore, because the cable was laying flat against the mast, I think there's not much of a problem. But I think that you could have a little bit of a hot cable technique with that approach, but that's a minor difference. That was way back in roughly 1980 on that patent. Since it's more than 18 years old, that means you can't earn a profit on it today. But rather very well-written patent. And my like you said, you selected an extremely good lawyer on that one. Back to you, Hal, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Agency. Well, the patent is being upgraded. Ed from Weimark is upgrading the patent using some of the stuff from the original to the new patent. And the new patent is even more exotic. The open stub allows a DC path for control, which I'll have to show you in the module, that you're able to switch in.